Good morning, diners and travelers. You're listening to On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And the show today will take a bit of it to back in the UK, but we will also have a detour to, well, not really through Chicago, but through just catching up with an old friend of ours from Chicago, both a wonderful chef and a wonderful woman. But to start out with, we're going to be talking to Camellia Punjabi. And if you don't know Chutney Mary, I mean, we've known it through so many different configurations, and it's now probably one of the most elegant and lively Indian, classical Indian restaurants in London, and with a vivacious bar. And we had a fabulous meal. I might say that the interview we did is about Chutney Mary, because that's where we were having dinner with Camellia when we interviewed her. But we also did a side tour with the entire family. Now, we're talking all ages and whatnot, to Marsala Zone, which is, I think there are four of them in that mini, more casual chain. And everybody had something different and enjoyed it, and it was a wonderful experience. I might mention that I was totally enthralled with the decor, which is all these fabulous Indian puppets, folk art. Anyhow, we'll start with that.
So you can go super upmarket with Chutney Mary.
Oh, which I love. I love the chef and everything.
Or you can go mainstream with Indian street food, as they describe it.
Exactly.
At the Marsala Zones, which are, you know, there are several of them in different parts of London, so you can find them there too. So anyway, here's our conversation with
Camellia Punjabi. Camellia Punjabi and the other owners, servers, managers, whoever, at Chutney Mary have become almost like our best friends or even relatives, because we've been doing this for so long. Camellia, how long has Chutney Mary been open?
Chutney Mary is now 27 years old. For 25 years, it was located in Chelsea, London. And then 2 years ago, we moved to St. James's.
Now, we came here, I believe, as this new location on the opening day, and we were totally blown away by the spaciousness of it, the chicness of it, the architectural sophistication of it, every detail of it, including the bar. What is it Pukka Bar?
It is called the Pukka Bar. Pukka is an Anglo-Indian word which means completely tops.
Completely what?
Tops. Completely tops. Top of the situation.
Well, we sat there and had drinks, and that's a whole other story. You have a very unique drinks list, including cocktails that are typically Indian.
Yes, we've done some interesting cocktails with Indian-inspired influences. For example, we do a fabulous saffron martini.
Now, we did some of those, and we had some snacky things then, and then moved on to the serious food. Now, as I understand it, your recipes are both, your dishes are both traditional or created by your kitchen. Some of them your mother's, some of them your inventions, and you have the same chef you've had for years.
Yes, our cuisine, Indian cuisine, is playful, inventive, but we have all the traditional favorites, and we do them with a twist and with a touch of modernity.
Now, we looked at the menu, and then you had us pick things we liked, and then you added your recommendations. Our listeners really like to hear in detail
about the dishes themselves. Let me pick some. I mean, I would say that the crab cakes were rather superb. Now, the crab must come from Cornwall.
Yes, the crab cakes we do are 100% crab. There is no potato and no other filling. It's all fresh Devon crab. And it's done with Goan spices.
Now, some Indian restaurants that are like, I don't know, I don't want to sound like a snob, but are lower league, let you order spicing from like 1 to 10. There's none of that here. You actually know what you're doing with spicing, and there's nothing that's burning the roof of your mouth.
Actually, Indian food is what Indians eat every day. And if we burned our mouths, we would be in trouble. So the spices are always evenly matched and balanced, and never searing hot.
My favorite first course was the lobster, which you and your chefs invented in the kitchen. Tell us what that's like.
There is a famous dish in Bangalore called chili fry and pepper fry. And we just thought we would try the chili fry with lobster, which has never been done before.
I will dream about it, truly. And of course, I said the crab cakes. And what was the other thing? Peter loved the scallops. And tell us about the scallops.
Well, those of you who are really fastidious, particular gourmet eaters, know that sea scallops have two parts. They have a body and they have a roe. And in these United States where we live, the roe somehow disappears. It reappears here at Chutney Mary. How do you manage to make that happen?
Because the scallops we use are not farmed. They are from the sea, and they are diver caught and not dredged by trawlers. We get them fresh every morning.
Every morning? Does that mean 365 days a year, or are there seasonal issues involved?
We get them practically 362 days of the year. But the 3 or 4 days around Christmas, no, the fishermen don't go out.
When you asked me, I said, I didn't see any goat on the menu. And you said, oh, yes, there is. And it's called Kid, which is young baby goat, I guess. And we had a biryani, which is rice. You define it for me. It was fabulous.
Well, we do a special variation of the traditional biryani because we cook it largely with herbs, fresh coriander, fresh mint, fresh curry leaves, fresh ginger and garlic. And these are the main spices. That makes it fragrant and light.
And what are the others? We had dal. We had plenty of dal. We had the shrimp curry, which was fabulous. And you take advantage of all the local products that are very good here and use all of your history of fabulous Indian techniques. Tell us about what you do with the products here.
Well, we bring our key spices from India, which we buy at harvest time, and then we ship them across. Because otherwise, for the shrimp curry, we would never get the color and flavor if we didn't use the local Kashmiri chilies from India. We also bring some of our other spices. The most important thing is to buy them when the harvest comes, so we know we've got the best varieties of that year.
Well, I mean, the food here is wonderful. The atmosphere is wonderful. You paid attention to booze and wine and everything else. What?
Potatoes.
Oh, yeah, Peter's potatoes. We forgot potatoes. My husband, Peter, our co-host here, is in love with Indian spiced potatoes. And he will go extra mile any direction just to get them. And now we had them, and that was your mother's recipe.
And what was the key spice? Because I've had potatoes cooked in a similar way, spiced with fenugreek. You're using a different spice combination.
Well, what the key spice is raw mango, sun-dried and then powdered. That is what gives the little sour kick. And then, of course, we use the crushed Kashmiri chili and the cumin powder. But the cumin seed has to be roasted before it is powdered. And that combination gives the best flavor.
Long been a place where you have curry houses everywhere. And the English who have been brought up in, for years, although it's different now, but still, for years on a very bland diet, they respond to the curry houses. But we've been here twice now in this particular venue of your restaurant, and it's jam-packed. Tell me about the appeal to the English palate through your restaurant with this authentic, not hyped up Indian flavors.
Well, it's taken us a long time to achieve this customer following. In the early years when we opened, the customers used to tell us that we were not the real thing, because the real thing in their mind was the curry house. But over time, they have allowed us to lead them into the real mysterious world of great Indian cuisine. And today is Sunday evening, and we've been open. This is the second Sunday we have opened, and we are overwhelmed that we have 150 bookings tonight, and we had to turn away 45 people.
What was that look? Oh, yes. We forgot to mention that Chutney Mary is actually part of a family of restaurants which you began some years ago, and it has a new section, a new direction that's happening now.
Yes, we have the last decade or so ventured into a new range, a mid-price range of great Indian food called Masala Zone. And I hope that Peter will be visiting them quite soon.
But you've forgotten the ones that already have a Michelin star. And news listeners, this is not a big forecast. There's a third Michelin star coming right around the horizon, just around here. But let's mention the other two, just to be sure that people realize if they can't get in here, they have another place they can go.
I'm drinking a pot of tea now after all this wonderful wines and cocktails, and it has whole slices of ginger in it, and what else I have, I don't even know. It is so delicious. Everything you do seems to go above and beyond what you need to do to meet your mark, but you're so intelligent. Why did you ever get into this business? I mean, you have degrees from Cambridge University in economics. Why are you doing this?
I was many moons ago one of the first trainees to join the management division of the largest industrial house in India called Tata's. And 5 years down the line, they transferred me to the Indian Hotels Company, which is the Taj Group of Hotels. When they did a joint venture with Intercontinental. And so like Topsy in Alice in Wonderland, I just growed into this business. And then 10 years ago, I retired and came and joined my sister and brother-in-law to open this company. They were already in the business, having Veera Swami and Chutney Mary, and then we added Amaya and the seven masala zones.
Well, the only thing I can have left to say is that we love it, and every time we come here, it feels like coming home, because you are offering not only great food and a great atmosphere, but really warm hospitality. Thank you so much.
Thank you for being here.
And just to make sure, listeners, you're not confused about the backstory. The backstory is that Camille was a graduate student at Cambridge University from 1961 to 1963. Those of you know Peter know that he was an undergraduate student. A little student worm from 1960 to 1963. I can't imagine why we never met then, but I'm so delighted that we met now.
Me too.
And don't go away, because after the break, we're going to have a wonderful chat with an old friend in London, followed by a chat with an old friend from Chicago. Nothing like having friends all over the globe. But in the meantime, here's a quick message, and then we'll be right back.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back, and so exciting to re-meet and have a chance to talk again to chefs that we've known for a long time that we really respect. And thus it was with our encounter in the UK with Peter Gordon, Providoris, and he's just a wonderful guy, a New Zealander. We won't hold that against him, right?
No, we won't. We certainly won't.
He's a great representative of the quality of cuisine in New Zealand.
And he has business interests all over the globe, we might add.
Oh, yeah.
And not only that, but he's just the nicest guy.
Exactly.
Who just happens to be a terrific chef. He writes cookbooks. He has a philosophical view of the world of fine dining, even though he's an important part of it.
Just always
an interesting conversation. It was so good to catch up with him again. You'll have heard him before, and if you haven't heard him before, you'll want to hear him again sometime in the future. And I promise you we'll do that. One of these days we might actually catch up with him in New Zealand. You never can tell.
I've never been to New Zealand.
In fact, he said that his restaurant in Auckland, thanks to a recent victory in the America's Cup over the Oracle Racing team of the United States, the America's Cup will next be held in waters off the coast of New Zealand. And you'll want to make your reservations now, because it's a big event, and his restaurant in an office tower looks right over where they're going to have those races. There you go. You see, you learn a little something every day at On the Menu. And here's Peter Gordon.
Do you need another glass of wine?
Of course. This is like, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. An old friend, a very beloved friend, Peter Gordon, ultimate chef, restaurateur, in Doris, which is your restaurant in London. You had a bigger empire in London, but most of those restaurants are closed, and now you have Tapas, and you have a Tapa room, and you have Providoris. Are you planning on expanding in London? You also, by the way, tell us about your restaurants back in your native land, New Zealand.
Providors, and we call the whole business the Providors, but the ground floor is the tap room. And we turned 16 this year, which is fantastic, actually. Last year, for the 15th, we held something that we call the alumni dinner, and we had seven previous chefs, head chefs and sous chefs, those that we could say, so Brad Farmery from New York, from Public, came to London and he cooked a course, and we got everyone to do a main course and then either some hors d'oeuvre or a dessert, and it was fantastic. We had Selim Kiazim, who's a Turkish Cypriot chef who was with us, and that was our head chef at Kolpapa, and she has just been on Great British Menu. And she was one of the three chefs chosen in the whole of Britain to do something at Wimbledon. And we had Anna Hansen, who was our former partner here from the Modern Pantry. She's fab. I saw her on the weekend. So Anna came, Brad came, Selin, Paul, Hamish, who's at Roca. He's the group executive chef at Roca. Miles Kirby, who has caravan restaurants and coffee roasting. Anyway, it was a nice big group of us. And so we did that last year, and this year we think, oh, can we not have to celebrate 16? Because there was so much going on last year. But we had Kolpapa restaurant for 5 years, and we sold that last year. Someone approached us, and we all thought, oh no, we don't want to do that. You know, we love having this restaurant in the West End and Seven Dials in Covent Garden. But we kind of looked around, and we thought we have a donut business here called Crosstown. And that's just going gangbusters. So Crosstown is now coming up for 4 years old, and we produce these amazing gourmet donuts. And the sourdough that we use in our donuts is the sourdough from the Providors, so it's 16 years old almost. And we produce these beautiful donuts. We have outlets in Soho, Victoria, Camden, Brick Lane. We're between the two famous bagel shops in Brick Lane. And we're doing donuts like banana, salted caramel, with a Lamington donut, a matcha green tea donuts, mango donuts, peach donuts. I mean, they're really, in that way that gourmet donuts, you know, because we did some research in the States a couple of years ago as well, you know, and that whole thing. But if you were to Google, you know, gourmet donuts UK, you'll find Crosstown comes up as the number one. So that business was doing so well, and there's a group of us involved in that, that we thought, four of us who were part of Kolpapa, we thought, actually, someone's made an offer, this means we can focus on the Crosstown business, so that's been very good, you know, it allowed us to refocus our energies and stuff. And then we're looking for something else to do in London, but Michael and I, my business partner here, we just don't exactly know. Isn't it funny? We don't actually know what it is we want to do. We know we want to do something. Today I was looking at a railway arch in Bethnal Green and two properties in Hackney, where I live. And we're looking for somewhere that I think to call it a lab makes it sound too highfalutin or something. Because I cook in the restaurant and I cook at home, but I feel like I'd like a space where I just can just spend the day pottering away, not taking up. Like if you're in the kitchen here, you take up a lot of space because our kitchen is tiny. So we'd like to look at a space that we could probably do a bit of a cooking school, and not a permanent, nothing like Le Cordon Bleu, nothing of that ilk, but you know, something where you could do focused workshops, where you could do, say, you know, once you know, maybe do 2 nights or 2 days a week, and you have up to 15 people maximum, and you do, I don't know, team building thing with people. And I love giving cooking demos. So we're trying to figure out what it is we need. And it's really interesting when you begin to look at what you think you want, and then you suddenly go, actually, is that what I want? So we're slightly unfocused, but know we want to find something. And I'd like to move all the various offices into the one building, because we're in South London down near Clapham. We're here at the Providors. We're in my house in London Fields. So we're trying to bring everything together. So that would be good. And then in New Zealand, I've got the Sugar Club, which is 4 years old this year, and that's on the 53rd floor of the Sky Tower in Auckland. So it's amazing. The east looks over the Pacific Ocean, and the west looks to the Tasman Sea towards Australia. And when the America's Cup, which we've just won, bravo, excellent. When that comes back to New Zealand, you will be able to see all the races from the restaurant. So, because we look out across what will be the race, not the racetrack. What do you call it? The bit of water, bit of ocean that they race on. Whatever you call that. Yeah. So, and then I have Bayota, which is a Spanish restaurant in Auckland. It means acorn. And that'll be 11 years old this year. So it's quite nice. Yeah, last year we had the Providors turning 15, Bayota turning 10, the Sugar Club was 3, Kaupapa was 5. It was a lot of nice things going on.
You know, we've known you for so long, but I've never asked you, what is it with the Spanish influence? Because you've got the Providores, you've got the Tapa Room. I never heard that story.
I guess it's just, what is it? I think it's, when I first came to Europe, the very first time, back in 1986, I went to Paris and I went to Amsterdam. I traveled a year through Southeast Asia, arrived in England, and then went back and set up the kitchen of the Sugar Club in Wellington in 1986. And when I came back next time, I went to, we came back in 89, and then holidays seemed to be in France and Italy mainly, in Tuscany, with good friends. And then I remember the first time I went to Spain, to Barcelona, and then to Madrid, and I thought, oh my God. And it was like discovering, it was like a whole palette of flavors that I just didn't know existed. There was smoked paprika and manchego chews and, you know, Montenegro and, gorgeous garbanzos, chickpeas, and it was like, and I found that really interesting. I love Italian food, like the River Cafe is one of my favorite restaurants. I love that. But I love the produce of Spain, going to the markets and going to Valencia and, I fell in love with Spain and the ingredients, and I began to use a lot in my cooking. And when we opened the Sugar Club in Notting Hill in 95, I was approached by the Spanish government. They have a department called Foods from Spain, and Maria Jose Sevilla approached me and said, you know, Peter, why do you use all these Spanish ingredients? I said, well, I suppose I use a lot of Japanese ingredients and Spanish, and it was just because I found smoked paprika, pimenton, delicious, and I found these things. And so I then began doing some consultancy work for the Spanish government, and which involved terrible things like having to go to El Bulli with a group of journalists and then having to take a private coach and go to Arzac for lunch and then, all these awful things. It was so hard for me. And so I fell in love with the country even more so. And I've been to Spain a lot. I mean, I barely speak a word of Spanish. I'm terrible. But I fell in love with the produce and the countryside, and I just love it. It's kind of more it could have been Italian, it could have been French or something, but it was the Spanish vibe that really got me. And when I opened Bayota 11 years ago in Auckland, Sky City, where I have my restaurants, they said, oh, we've got this space on Federal Street, we'd love something in there. What would you do? Do you want to do something? And I said, well, and I looked around in New Zealand and I thought, actually, everyone who has a tapas bar is a bit fusion, and everything was, you know, they'd have some lovely, I don't know, there'd be a bit of coconut cream or something. And I thought, oh, this is very purist. I said, I think the gap in the market here is a really pure Spanish-only, it doesn't have to be classical, but it shouldn't be crazy fusion. So we created that, and we had the first, it was really hard 11 years ago to find a lot of Spanish wines. You could find Rioja, of course, and Crianza, but it was in the Albariño, but you couldn't find a lot of, wine. So I broadened the scope to be any country that spoke Spanish. So suddenly we were allowed to, you know, we allowed ourselves to bring in wines from, Chile and Argentina. And then I said any Spanish varietal. So Trinity Hill, we're grown a Tempranillo. So we allowed ourselves to have, so we had Spanish-ish wines, and now Bayota in Auckland has the wine is 100% Spanish, which is the only restaurant in the country like it, and we import wines ourselves. So I think I like the grittiness of Spain and of the food, and I like the earthiness of the flavors, and And I've been to Spain and done the matanza. We butcher a pig and you make blood sausage and you... Oh, and we may, you know... I'll just say, I love the vibe. You know, I think if I come back again, I'll come back Spanish.
You might have been. Who knows? I mean, the Spanish and the Portuguese have been just about everywhere, so you might have been. I asked you before, like, to really notable about the changes in mining in London, particularly, and you had some. You had some ideas about your generation as to the end of vis-a-vis the next generation. Could you reiterate those?
I think what's great in London is if you want high-end three-star Michelin dining, you can get it. What we see is that that's the younger generation, and these are chefs in their 20s and 30s, who are prepared to take on short leases or, you know, pop-ups have been around for a while, of course, but a lot of these youngsters are kind of, they're fearless and they're prepared to take on a lease of something that's not going to be around for a long time. So whilst I'm looking for a property at the moment, I need to know that I've probably got a 10-year lease, unless we're going to buy the building, so we're looking at that as well. So we're looking at long-term strategy. But for the young folk, what they're looking for is a chance to get their foot in the door and do things. So one of my favourite restaurants in East London over near Spitalfields Market is a Thai restaurant called Somsar, and it's a group of chefs who work with the Australian chef David Thompson, one of the world's leading Thai sort of restaurant-y chefs, and they started where I live in London Fields. There's a series of railway arches. One of them is a coffee roasting business called Climpson's and Sons, and Climpson's have been really well known for having giving young people an opportunity. And Somsar were a restaurant, a Thai restaurant there, and they just opened a few days a week, and they had charcoal fire and barbecue, and they produced this lovely northern Thai food. And then they did a crowdfunding project, like young people do, and they raised a lot of money, and they got a property in Commercial Street, not far down from St. John Bread and Wine at the back of Spitalfields Market. Yeah. And they've opened this restaurant, and it's packed, and it's so exciting, and you go in. So they've moved from pop-up to serious, you know, tenants and signing leases. But I was there recently, and they had some, they're getting some strange beetles. Yeah, but they get in and then they're dead, of course, when they get them. But they squeeze the juice out and they ferment them with fish sauce, and it produces some, I know it sounds gruesome, right? But it's very tasty. And their food is, I don't know, they're doing really funky things. They fly in fresh produce from Thailand, on a couple of times a week. So they're getting, when you're going there and you're having lychee or golden aubergine or whatever, they've arrived themselves. You know, they're getting curry pastes produced in Thailand, and they're staying true to the tenets of Thai cuisine set up by David Thompson. And they're, you know, they're really funky. Then there's where I live as well. There's a butcher shop called Hill and Zrock on Broadway Market in London Fields in Hackney, just up from the canal. And during the day, it's a butcher shop, and some of the best meat you'll buy. It's beautiful. I buy from my meat from them all the time. But in the evening from 7 o'clock, they become a restaurant. So the marble slab where they break down a carcass during the day, they shut at 5 o'clock, and then 2 hours later they reopen. And they produce a very simple menu, and your main courses really will be a lamb chop, a breast of chicken, maybe a sirloin, 1 kilogram sirloin. And their starters will be very simple things, but they'll be like purple sprouting broccoli with anchovy sauce, lovely pork rillette. A while ago, Jamie, who's running the kitchen, put a few shellfish dishes on, which I thought was great, but I haven't seen them again. I think they tried the seafood thing. So they're doing that. Then you'll find little food trucks all over the place, markets where a lot of traders get together. There's just lots of stuff. Because when I moved to London in 89, there was high-end French, And that was about it. Yeah, there were terrible cafes that were vague. Everything was French, actually. There were chains of cafes that were French by name, but awful coffee and baguettes and things, and very little else.
You know, one of the things that worries me out in New York and London across the globe is that French food is making this big comeback, but it's all the wrong aspects of French food.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not France's biggest fan, I have to say. You know, I find far more interesting food in Italy, in Turkey, in Greece, and it's not that I'm anti-French, but I think when I did my apprenticeship in Australia, it was all French, and I used to think, can't we have a Thai curry, or can't we have a bit of tofu, or can't we have a bit, and it's all, I think anyway, that's just my view.
Now, Peter wants to talk to you about your wine.
This is the most delicious wine list of New Zealand wines, I think, that must be in captivity. But we should do an RIP. We should do an RIP for, why don't you introduce the RIP wine?
Okay. Well, the wine we're saying farewell to, I think you bought the second to last bottle in existence, apart from a couple in my home and my business partner's home, but it's called Waitaki Braids, and it's a Pinot Noir. And it's from a vineyard that we were partners in, it's in the Waitaki Valley, which is north Otago. So a lot of wine aficionados will know of central Otago. Things like Felton Road is probably one of our leading vineyards from central Otago. But north Otago is a little bit east of there. It's on the Waitaki River Valley. It's where Hakataramea joins Kudo. And if anyone's ever watched the film Narnia, through the wardrobe or something. That's filmed in the Waitaki Valley region. And we were joking earlier. Someone once said, if you want to make a small fortune in wine, start with a large fortune. Well, there are a group of us, four of us, including the wonderful winemaker Michelle Richardson, who used to make all the wines for Villa Maria. She was the head winemaker there and various other places. And a group of us went in and put some money into this vineyard, and we produced wonderful Riesling, Pinot Gris, Pinot Noir, and a Pinot Noir Rosé. And Jancis Robson, when she released the Oxford Companion to Wine, maybe in, how many years ago would that have been? Maybe 9 or 10 years ago. She was asked, as they do when you're doing a launch or something like that, name the 9 most promising potential vineyards in the world. And the one vineyard she chose from New Zealand was ours. So she had one from Spain, one from France. So we had great story, great background, great support, lovely wine. And then things happened to our business partner, Steve, and it just crumbled. So the vineyard is no longer. And it was a really interesting experience because when I was 17, I went to university in New Zealand. I'd always wanted to be a chef, but I didn't get I'd applied for an apprenticeship with Air New Zealand, and I didn't get the job. And then I thought, well, what am I going to do? I was 17. I thought, I have no idea. So I went off to university to study horticultural science to become a winemaker. So I didn't finish the degree at all. I moved to Australia and then got a job as a chef, which is exactly what I wanted to. So I guess, in a way, when we became involved in Waitaki Braids, and it's called that because it's on the Waitaki River, and it's a braided river, which means it's just this beautiful meandering as it comes down to, it starts at the top of Mount Cook, Aoraki, the highest mountain in New Zealand. It ends up on the east coast of New Zealand near between Oamaru and Christchurch. And it's this beautiful meandering river. So, yeah, it was an easy thing to invest in because it's so beautiful and Michelle is so talented. But, business now sort of, we should have been more focused on the business.
Who knows? Maybe you'll do it again. Maybe you'll get the craze one more time. In the meantime, RIP Waitaki Braids Pinot Noir, second to last bottle. Sweetheart?
Well, I mean, I think that we'd be remiss if we did not discuss some of the food we had today. Now, a lot of this is coming out of your cookbook that we interviewed you about by phone. About the stuff that we liked. I mean, we liked, what did we have? We had the...
Yeah, I don't see it, the chipotle.
The Chipperones, and that's from that menu. Yeah, how'd you get those?
You can still get Jersey Rolls at the moment. Yeah. The thing, I think Jersey Rolls, they're harvesting them a bit bigger as well, and it does seem to be the season is longer, and I don't know, to be honest, if it's the warming or something, but I bought some Jersey Royals yesterday actually from Waitrose supermarket, and they're much bigger and less sandy and totally delicious. So yeah, they're still around.
Of course, we had the mixed leaf salad. I mean, you wrote a whole book about salads. So why are you so serious about salads?
I find with salads you can be quite playful. So, and in the book I'm loose with the things. Like there's a, I was in New Zealand last week and I was cooking one of the dishes from the book, Savour, and it was a venison pumpkin coconut curry. And I looked at it and I thought, seriously, this is so not a salad. But the way it's sort of placed up, you could almost pretend that it was. So what I like with salads is you have a variety of components that you prep separately. And then you plate up as opposed, because someone said, what's the difference between a salad and a stew, which to me was quite obvious. But I guess with a stew or a casserole, you put lots of components together and you cook them together. And with a salad, you prepare things separately, like most main courses or plates in restaurants are, really, isn't it? It's the way you present it in many ways.
Well, you know, talking to you about the restaurant scene in London, I agree that people talk not so much now about the restaurants as much as they talk about a given dish at a restaurant. Like we had lunch at Dinings, and one of your very fine food writers and editors said that's the best aubergine in London. And we ate someplace else, and I can't remember what was the dish now, and they said, oh, liver, and that's the best liver. Okay, what would yours be?
What we've become really well known for, which we find quite funny, is our Turkish eggs. So we in Turkey, because I was involved in restaurants for almost 20 years in Istanbul, one restaurant called Changa, one called Muze de Changa. And the guys who have that Tarık and Savaş, they closed Muze de Changa this year. And it was amazing. It won Wallpaper Magazine Best Restaurant Design in the World 1 year. It's on the Sabancı Selçuk Museum on the Bosphorus. Amazing. So I've been to Turkey probably more than 50 times. I love it. It's just, you know, people are fantastic. Food's amazing. And there's a dish there called çilbir. And çilbir is kind of in the same way that Tanesca sauce on pasta is known as horse pasta. Çilbir is kind of known as a low-rent, basic food. And it's basically poached eggs with yogurt and a chili oil on it. And then I came back in when we opened the Providors 16 years ago. We put Turkish eggs on our breakfast and brunch menu. And now it's on our all-day taproom menu. And we have people who come around the world just to have the Turkish eggs. And it's Greek-style thick, plain, strained yogurt whipped up with olive oil at room temperature, and then two poached eggs and a bit more yogurt on top. And then we cook butter to a beurre noisette stage. And we had some kırmızı biber, which are Aleppo chili flakes. We take the butter off the heat, add the chili flakes, add some extra virgin olive oil, and let it settle. And we spoon that over the top of the eggs. And much as that might sound really unattractive, it is the most delicious thing. And it's something that I eat at least once a week. So a dish that we have on our brekkie menu is the dish that most people associate with us these days. It's funny, you know, through Instagram or through social media. But what has been interesting is that now put it on the menu at Kolpapa as well for our breakfast menu. And then we suddenly began to realize it's almost like it's the new eggs Florentine or something. You now see reference to, their Turkish eggs aren't as good as those two. So Turkish eggs, the phrase, which came from here, is now sort of a stalwart on British cafe casual restaurant menus. It's really interesting. We look at it and go, okay, that's good. You know, we'd like to be really famous for, I don't know, we do our scallops with sweet chili sauce and creme fraiche that Brad did at Public as well. Now we do our menu changes so often. You know, but I think our chefs would like to be known for doing, you know, a lovely lamb chump dish or a lovely sea bass dish, but actually Turkish eggs. That's the one.
Why didn't I have those?
Well, it's people look at it as very much a brunchy thing, but it's, you can come. I mean, breakfast, lunch, and dinner here 7 days a week.
Love seeing you again. Love catching up with what you've been doing. You're just one of the most delightful chefs. Chefs used to be very defined, narrowly defined, and I find the only thing I really, the thing I enjoy most about my job is just meeting people like you who have this broad vision of things. And you know a little bit, at least, about just about everything.
Well, I think I'm just super inquisitive. You know, I really, and I think that's why the food I do, this, you know, fusion food that I do is that, because I can't imagine when you discover a new ingredient, no matter where it's from, that you wouldn't want to cook with it. So I think if I was, you know, if I was defined by being a regional fresh, you know, chef in Languedoc or Tuscany or something, and I could only use those ingredients, I'd struggle, because I'd be like, oh, can't I put a curry leaf here or there, a bit of star anise or a, you know, a bit of tofu or something. So, I'm just naturally inquisitive. And I think, you know, chefs, like we do joke when we get together, you know, that in the old days, you know, chefs needed a knife and a chopping board, and now chefs need an Instagram account, and they need to do this, and they need to be aware of, you know, the social world around them. But I mean, I look at my career, and I think I'm so lucky. I was saying earlier, you know, recently in Venice for the Art Biennale, I did a dinner for 300 on an island. We coordinated a dinner with the Navy. It involved art. I've done a lot of art fundraising events in New Zealand, and I just find the creative world, whether it be food or you know, visual arts, whether it's film or painters or sculptors or something, I find it just so interesting. You know, what a lucky world we live in. In times of chaos like we are, you know, and in Britain with Brexit, which is making a lot of our staff, you know, because here we have 42 employees and we have only, there'd be 9 that are English born and bred, British born and bred. So the rest of them are like, well, will we be allowed to stay here once Brexit goes through? And no one knows, you know, no one knows what's going on. And, you know, in this industry we work in, we rely on people from all around the world. And that's what makes it such a fascinating world to be involved in. But there's uncertainty, and that's tough on our people, really.
And ours as well, and I need not say more. Well, with friends like you, we stay happy doing what we do. Thank you very much, Peter Gordon.
Pleasure. And really, really nice to see you both here in London again. Really, really nice. Thank you.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Now, we have a good gig in many ways by doing the things that we do, but one of the great benefits and privileges is getting to know and befriend people. And in our world, chefs are particularly interesting. And so it is that I'm really proud to say that we're friends with Gail Gand. And she has so much energy, boundless energy, and discipline and inventiveness, and I don't know what.
She's always up to something new.
So anyhow, I saw her at the Beard Awards, but we didn't have time to talk, so we had her call, and we got a chance to catch up. And so here it is, Chef Gail Gand. This is fun, Gail Gand, to have chance to chat with a friend.
Thank you. That's so sweet.
Yeah, it's almost like not working, right? Can you give our listeners, although I'm sure that it's probably not necessary, a synopsis of where you've been as a chef?
Sure. You know, I've been in the business 40 years now, and
oh
I was
God.
Mostly a pastry chef. Yes, can you believe it? I went to school at La Varenne. I started a restaurant, Trio, in I think it was the early 90s in Chicago, which got national attention, and I got a Food and Wine, you know, Best New Chef's Award from mm-hmm. that. Also did
one of the
True,
few women, by the way, that gets this. I said it's one of, you're
she's
one of the few women who's gotten that award.
She's on her soapbox.
Yeah,
she's on her soapbox.
That's true. And then I opened True in 1999, and I have 2 James Beard Awards from that, and it has 2 Michelin stars right now.
Oh, really? Oh, that's
kind
great.
Nice.
I don't know why
yeah.
I lost that.
But it's 18 years old, and during that time, I had a show on the Food Network for 10 years. It was called Sweet Dreams. It was the first ever all-dessert, all-pastry show. And then I write cookbooks. I've got 8 books out now. My latest is Gilgan's Lunch. And
yeah, we interviewed you about that one, about lunch, remember?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
I think I was... I was like doing the college hunt with my son. I was on the road.
I think
college.
So,
he's
yeah.
a senior now, which is nice. But and I teach a lot. I travel a lot in the country doing food and wine festivals. So you'll see me appear, you know, at Epcot Food and Wine or Denver Food and Wine or San Diego or Hawaii is one of the ones I get to do this year. Hawaii Food and Wine in October. So that's a little bit about me.
Yeah, I always wanted to go to that La Bernadette thing. What does he do? Eric Repair does one in the Bahamas or someplace. Where is it?
You know, we all get to go very exotic, wonderful places as chefs. Last summer, I went to Tahiti on a cruise to take a group of people to a vanilla plantation.
Oh, yeah?
You know, and they call that work. Yeah, I mean, it was, you know, I got to travel all through French Polynesia. And I've written a book about chocolate and vanilla, so I know all about it, but I'd never actually touched a vanilla vine. And I can tell you, for me, it was like a life change. Like my knees buckled when I finally saw the real thing.
Wow.
It's really something.
You know, I've been to Tahiti.
Have you?
Uh-huh.
Did you see a vanilla plantation while you were there?
No, I was kind of clueless. I was doing... it was my crazed phase of my life, and I was bumming around the South Pacific.
And sounds very exotic.
Oh, it was very, you know, it was very hippie, flower child.
Yeah, that's what I'm picturing you with no shoes, you know, and long hair.
But, you know, actually, you can't just do that. I learned this the hard way. You can't be a general bum. You have to be an expert at something. Like you're, you know, a diving bum or a ski bum or a, you know.
Or a dessert bum.
You know, a vanilla bum.
I'm a dessert bum.
Yeah. Now, but I love that whole thing. I mean, I've been in places like Tonga. Have you ever been to Tonga?
No, but
well, it was a phase.
Mr. Tonga got famous during the Olympics.
We all noticed him. Yes.
Never that.
Now, tell me this. Is there a dessert that's particularly associated with you?
You know, one of the desserts I do a lot at large events, so if I'm, you know, serving like 200 people or more, I often do this buttermilk panna cotta with strawberry mash.
So it's
a panna cotta, but I sort of Americanize it by putting a very American ingredient in it, which is buttermilk, and it gives it sort of a tang.
Uh-huh.
And then I'll do either raspberries in hibiscus syrup or strawberries that I just kind of mash. Depends on what season. It's strawberry season right now in Chicago.
Oh, yeah. We just got our homegrown ones for the first time last week, and it's fabulous.
I'm trying to carve out like an afternoon to take the kids strawberry picking, to take my child labor strawberry
mash
so we can make jam. So this time of year I would do a strawberry mash, which is literally just mashed up strawberries.
I used to do that with the raspberries because we had such a good crop of them, and I could freeze them and use them all winter.
That's great.
Yeah.
So maybe that. I do a chocolate powder creme with black pepper whipped cream.
Oh, nice.
And I do a butterscotch pudding with salt and pepper peanuts.
That's
so
nice.
Often I'm using a little bit of savory, but you know, I've been using savory in desserts for like 20 years. So people ask me, is that the new trend? I'm like, you know, I started 20 years ago. So I don't know, but I do like bringing pepper into some desserts. It seems to work really well. Mm-hmm. So I use white pepper or Szechuan peppercorns or black pepper or whatever.
Well, I made a conscious effort to use pepper because of all the, I got this book called, what was it, Spice Heroes.
Right.
And it talked about all the benefits of these traditional spices. So we
health benefits?
Hmm?
Yes.
Health benefits? Oh, nice.
Yeah. And so, I mean, we started, I make a point of putting the grinding of black pepper onto my eggs and stuff mm-hmm. like that. So, and we also were using a lot of turmeric.
You know, you can put it in things like shortbread or whipped cream because the butter fat in there kind of coats your tongue so you don't get as much of the heat, but you get the subtle other parts of its flavor. You know, a lot of people uh-huh. don't realize pepper has a flavor besides its heat. And that's one way to,
well,
to bring
you know,
that out.
Since you're in Chicago, what's her name?
Spit it out now.
I'm trying to remember the Mexican gal. I mean, the Mexican guys.
Rick Bayless.
What's her name? Deanna.
Deanna Bayless?
Did a chili tasting for Women Chef and Restaurateurs once.
Oh.
And we were all tasting and having to describe, and we could not use the word heat or anything having to do with heat. So you got to pay attention to the flavors of the chilies. It was very interesting.
Yeah, you have to go behind the initial heat and then uh-huh. start perceiving what's really going on. So by putting it into like a buttery dough like shortbread, it kind of cancels out a little bit of the heat so you can taste the other flavors going on.
Now, you know, Grant Achatz was at the Melbourne Food and Wine Festival, and he did a demo, and he made, I don't know, there were hundreds of people in this auditorium, and they did a production line doing those sugar balloons, so mm-hmm. that everybody came up and got a sugar balloon, and it was the best advertising, because everywhere you looked, there was one of Grant Achatz's balloons. Sugar balloons.
And, oh, that's fun.
And he had a long line to sign his book.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my.
I went up behind him, and he couldn't see who I was. I went up from behind him, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, can I touch you?
What do you
king,
say?
The king. So, anyway.
You already have.
So, now, have you noticed any changes in the dining culture of Chicago since we have had the Beards there for the last 3 years?
Just more of it, you know. There's even more restaurants than ever before, more excitement, more, I think more from scratch cooking, so mm-hmm. more like pasta being made from scratch, and, you know, people grinding their own flour and making ramen noodles from scratch with very expensive equipment shipped in from China, but
really?
You know, instead of buying the noodles already made, we're you know, touching things with our hands a little more than maybe previously, but it's, you know, it's such a thriving restaurant world here in Chicago,
yeah.
which is great for all our ethnic neighborhoods and, you know, diverse backgrounds. You know, even our soul food now is like getting noticed and getting some publicity, and, you know, people are starting to go into some of the neighborhoods like Austin and Back of the Yards and Bronzeville, where, you know, some African-American chefs have their stuff going on, and
mm-hmm.
you know, there's a really nice mix and crossover happening, I think, in Chicago.
Yeah, we went to the restaurant Fat Rice.
What's it called?
It's called Fat Rice, and
Fat Rice, yeah.
The people who own it wrote a book about it called Fat Rice too.
Uh huh. Did you like it?
It turned out we didn't have fat rice.
No, we never got the fat rice. We ate something else.
We ate too much other stuff, and they said
you never got to. You were too fat before you got to the rice.
Something like that. The other thing I noticed, and I don't really know where Chicago got this nomenclature, the city of broad shoulders. But
I know where
what I know is it's
It was Sandberg that wrote that, right?
Yes, Carl Sandberg.
Carl Sandberg called us that.
Okay, well, I have a...
You never asked me.
I have a new name. It's called the City of Sharp Elbows.
Why is that?
This is crowded. This is what it's like at the James Beard Awards in the Lyric Opera. I mean, you can't go anywhere.
I'm not sure the Lyric Opera is a big enough venue for.
I think that's probably got something to do with it because.
Though I don't know where we would go next. You know, Rahm Emanuel, we'll have to figure out where to push it to. But we've been so happy to have it here, and it seems like people like coming to Chicago. It's centrally located. There's a lot to see. The chefs are very excited to have, you know, everyone from out of town. And
it's a good booth.
You got that 4-page list of parties to go to, but, you know, there's just so much going on during Beard Week. It's really exciting and really fun.
Yeah, I think that there are actually more activities and with the beards in Chicago than when it was in New York. In New York,
I think you're right.
Yeah, in New York it was more... Well, it's like any kind of convention. Once you put it in New York, there are so many other things to go to. You don't have to stick with your crew. You know what I mean?
Well, and it's new to Chicago, and we're really, you know, everyone wants to be a part of it. They couldn't necessarily go to New York and be a part of it. So for some people, this is the first time they're able to, you know, rub those elbows.
Yeah,
Beard people, beard officials, and the awards themselves, I think, have gotten much more polished. Like, you know, the MCs now are television talent. They're not just, you know, culinary's best public speakers. You know, Jesse Tyler Ferguson is, you know, from Modern Family, was our MC this year, and who's a big foodie, apparently. But, you know, we loved having him in town. That was so great, and he's so... such a pro.
So is it still a tight-knit community in Chicago with chefs?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think it is. We have our own Chicago festival. We have Chicago Gourmet.
Right.
That's been going on a bunch of years now.
And that's a very successful event.
Yeah. Yeah, it is a very tight community. You know, some of us are getting a little older now.
Yeah.
You know, we started decades ago, and some of our, you know, superstars like Paul Bartolotta and Tony Montuano and John Hogan, you know, we're all kind of middle-aged now and maybe don't want to work quite as hard, but still have a lot of knowledge and, you know, some, still a little bit of energy left. So,
but, you know, the person who I find so amazing is Joyce Goldstein.
I was just with Joyce last weekend in San Francisco.
How were you?
Yeah. I was at a 60th birthday party for Emily Lucchetti.
She's Emily 60?
We're all 60. I turned 60 this year, too.
Oh, wow. I always knew her as a little girl, you know, Emily.
Yeah. So she had this fantastic birthday party in San Francisco. Jonathan Waxman made the lunch, and I used to work for Jonathan at Jams in New York. I'm a Jams girl. And Joyce was there, and it was the most fun event for a myriad reasons, but one of them was anyone who was a local pastry chef that came to the party was asked to bring a cake.
So
there was about 25 cakes, all different kinds, each cooked by, you know, another fantastic pastry chef. And when it came time to serve them, you know, there were 60 of us at the party. So how do you cut 25 cakes into 60 slices?
What did you do?
You don't. So what they did was they handed out 60 forks,
We
just dove in to all the cakes. It was I'm so doing that the next time I have an event that's like dessert for 100. Uh-huh. I'm going to do 10 different cakes and just hand out 100 forks.
Oh, that's funny.
It was so fun. You just kept, you know, you'd go to one and take a bite. And for pastry chefs, like, we don't need a whole slice of something. We just want a taste. You know, we just want to know what's going on. It's our curiosity that keeps us going. And it was the most fun. And Joyce was there. It was great to see her, you know, still showing up.
Yeah, well, she opened her first restaurant at 40, which I thought was gutsy.
She told me that. Yeah. I couldn't believe that.
Yeah.
I think the first time I met her, let's see, I was living in England from 1990 to 92 or 93. When I was married to Rick Tremonto, and then we came back from England, and we sort of had missed the whole California cuisine thing.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so we went to California for a month, and we just went to every, you know, we met Nancy Yokes, and we went to Joyce Goldstein's, and we went to meet Alice Waters, and you know, we went to Nancy Silverton's in LA, we went to LA, San Francisco, and then up to Napa, and just tried to, like, crash course it, you know, met Michael Chiarello, and just saw what everyone was doing, Cindy Paulson, and I remember, you know, just hanging out in Joyce's kitchen with her at that time, so that, she might have just been starting then.
Yeah. Well, it's really wonderful catching up, Gail. I mean, but I hope we run into each other again soon.
Well, that's one of the good reasons of the Beard Awards being in Chicago. At least I see you once a year there in Chicago.
Yeah, exactly.
We'll see you then, if not before.
Yeah, maybe we'll catch up with you
maybe
at one of the...
Maybe in Hawaii or something.
Oh, that we are.
All right, you two take care.
Thanks, Gail. Bye.
Thank you. Have a good summer. Bye.
You too. Bye.
So there you have it, another On the Menu program for your enjoyment. And we hope you'll join us again for similar enjoyment, same time, same place next week. And until then,
goodbye. Oops. Bye-bye.